the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children has a new image on the front of its website. It's Wisconsin teen Jamie Kloss with the words under her picture, "This is why we never lose hope." There's no reliable way to determine the total number of children who are missing in the U.S. And the good news is the odds of a missing child being found is much higher today than it was several decades ago. We're talking about resources for the families of missing loved ones and the communities they live in. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's bring in Allison Fay now. She's director of the Jacob Wetterling Resource Center in Minneapolis. It aims to end all forms of child maltreatment through education, training, and prevention and advocacy for victims. Allison, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Jacob Wetterling was abducted and murdered in 1989, and his mother, Patty Wetterling, has said that police know how to find a stolen car because it happens frequently, but child abduction cases are less common, but it's important we know what to do in the event they occur. What have we learned in the years since Jacob Wetterling was abducted?
I think the big push is just the collaboration piece being so important. You know, one of the things you could tell in the press conference with Jamie's case is all the different agencies that invested time, people, and resources. And the more people that we have involved and the more agencies that are working to help, you know, it's more bodies, it's more energy. Sometimes back a few decades ago, it was very siloed with, you know, this is our case and no one else is going to touch it. And we found that that's not as helpful as having, you know, reaching out to resources like, as you mentioned, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children.
And there were approximately 3,500 tips in the Jamie Kloss case. How important are tips?
Well, it's tricky because we want people to, you know, err on the side of calling. If they feel like when people have a big case of a missing person, it's kind of like a puzzle and they're looking for that one piece that will help break the case. In this case, it was Jamie who provided that piece. But you never know if your piece is that information. The other flip side of that is people so want to help and their hearts are so invested that sometimes the next person they see, they'll think is you know, the person of concern. So law enforcement, they'll spend a lot of their time eliminating tips as they work to try to get the right information to come in.
The work you do at the Jacob Wetterling Resource Center focuses a lot on child abuse and abduction prevention. So what should parents be doing right now? What conversations should they be having with their kids about safety?
First of all, we are all about prevention, and it's a big part of it. And I think it's right now, this, you know, if you read the complaint yesterday, if you heard about it on the news, the details are horrific. And that if you're not completely, you know, floored and upset by reading it, I would be concerned. But we have to remember that there are kids who are looking at this information as well, and it can be terrifying. So right now it's really important for parents to reassure kids that they're special, that they deserve to be safe, that if anyone, you know, ever does anything that might make them feel scared, to let you know. These cases get a lot of publicity because they are so rare, and that can skew things for kids who see this stuff on, you know, when they're watching TV or they hear it on the school bus, and it can be terrifying. So we need to remind kids, it's your job to be a kid. It's my job to keep you safe. And let's talk about our family safety plan.
What is the details of a family safety plan? What does that look like?
The best way to talk about safety, the two main questions to talk about with kids of all ages. We don't focus on do we know the person or not, because in over 90% of the time, abusers and those who are harming children are people the child knows. We also know that most people do want to help kids, but the good news is most people don't harm kids. So you don't want to scare kids from people who they don't know. Like in Jamie's case, it was someone she didn't know who she approached and who helped her. So the two questions that we teach, instead of focusing on how we know someone, is how do they make you feel? The first question is this person trying to get me to break my rules? And the second question is, how does this person make me feel in my stomach? You know, do they give me an uh-oh feeling? Give me that mixing bowl in my tummy feeling? If either of those questions are, you know, if you ask, is this person trying to get me to break my rules? Does this person give me that uh-oh feeling? You have every right to leave that person and go check in with someone else who takes care of you. And so when we established those two conversations, we then followed up with a lot of what ifs. You know, what if someone that we know and like is asking to break our family safety rules? And we can reinforce the kids in those moments. I wouldn't be mad at you. I would want to know. I would believe you. Some of the many reasons why kids don't come forward with an adult is something that scares them.
Talking with Allison Fay, she's child abuse and abduction prevention advocate, directs the Jacob Wetterling Resource Center. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What resources does your community have to keep kids safe? Have you discussed safety with your child? And what rules or strategies does your family follow? How are you handling the Jamie Claus situation for yourself personally and for your children? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Allison, what you said there for a moment about the gut feeling, what's in your stomach, it reminded me of a piece I read over the weekend about the Jamie Claus situation. And a mother was being interviewed with her child by her side, her 10-year-old, and the child suddenly doubled over and said, and this is in the reporting, said their stomach hurts so much they think they're getting sick. How is this impacting our kids?
I think adults have to do a better job of thinking about how the words that we say impact kids. You know, for me personally, just looking at online, the amount of victim blaming that adults engage in online, you know, I wonder if this person has anything to do with the, you know, what message does that give to our kids, you know, when they see that? We know in almost all cases of abuse and abduction, when the child knows. So most kids don't tell for a wide variety of reasons. And so to have those things being talked about by adults, you know, questioning the victim, blaming the victim, what does that say to the child who hasn't come forward yet? And I think we have to own doing a better job of making it a culture where kids are respected, where adults are held accountable for hurting kids without, without vilifying our kids. And I think we have to do, you know, we can't wait for our kids to come to us. We need to be having proactive, positive conversations with them so that they know that they always have that safety net of people that they can talk to about problems.
You work in classrooms helping kids to recognize danger, and they often have stereotypical ideas of what can cause harm. How does giving kids scenarios and examples help them process potential threats that may not be the stereotypical threat of a stranger in the bushes?
Well, we don't want it to be on the children's shoulder. You know, it's up to kids' job to be a kid. We don't want to put the whole responsibility for safety on their shoulders because it's not fair. And it's not effective. What we want to be doing instead is teaching them the basics of, like, checking first. Okay, we check first before we get in the car with anybody. We check first before we go into anybody's house. And then it's up to the adult to be, as they're checking first to see if this is something that they want to do. The main rule, abductions are so rare. We have about 115 in the United States every year. They're very rare. And so the big safety rule with that is we don't go anywhere with anyone who doesn't let us check first.
We're talking about resources and abduction with Allison Fay. She directs the Jacob Wetterling Resource Center in Minnesota. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. What resources does your community have to keep kids safe? Have you discussed safety with your child recently? And what rules does your family follow? Are you an educator? How do you address safety in school? Call in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to the conversation in just a minute on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What we know is that it's very rare for a stranger to abduct a child. The Missing Children Division for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children breaks down their numbers this way. They help law enforcement with almost 6,500 active missing children cases at any given time. And in the most recent year studied, only 115 kidnappings were cases of children taken by strangers or very slight acquaintances. We're talking resources for communities and families with Allison Fay. She's a child abuse and abduction prevention advocate, and she directs the Jacob Wetterling Resource Center. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work in law enforcement? What would you like adults to know when it comes to child abuse and abductions? What resources does your community have to keep kids safe? Have you discussed safety with your child? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Allison, when an abducted child is found, or in Jamie Kloss's case, it's the beginning of a long journey for them, what should communities keep in mind when a child is returned?
I think it's important to just keep in mind to let the child have some space. I've been so impressed with what I've seen coming out of there, and just with the positive energy and the people rallying together, and the fact that they held on to the hope in such a public way for so long, which is a wonderful thing. And now it's time to take a deep breath, like they are doing, and give Jamie space as she adjusts to, with professionals, adjust to whatever is to come in her journey.
So what is that healing process like, and what are some of the interventions that there will be along the way?
It's often child-led. I don't know if you saw the press conference, but the sheriff did mention that they already had a reunification plan in place, which is wonderful. When they're not trying to put together, counselors and resources at the last minute, but they planned for when she comes home, here's what we're going to do, here are the things we're going to offer. And a lot of it is letting, adjusting to the child and where the child is at. Every person is different. People have different needs. And just for Jamie, it's really about just having that space, that time. We learn from kids who were abducted and have been found what works and what hasn't worked. And the idea of even just celebrity can be so uncomfortable because you feel like you're sort of in a spotlight. And so creating that new sense of normalcy and surrounding her with support will be so important.
We've seen pictures of her with a beaming smile with her dog, Molly. What can we take away from those pictures?
I think the important thing is that she is in a place now where she has the ability to rebuild in whatever that looks like. A lot of people will say, oh, she's found, so now we're at the end of the story. And for Jamie, she's at the beginning of her story. And she gets to decide what her story looks like. It's not this person who took control for this period of time. That chapter's done, and now she gets to take control and write her own story, and we can support her in doing that by not having her feel like that she's in the spotlight and not having her feel like that she's having that public pressure. So hopefully as people now have the details and are able to understand what happened, there'll be sort of some relaxing of that public eye and to give her and her family the space that they need.
Teachers often talk about current events in their classes. What recommendations would you give to teachers in how they talk about this Jamie Kloss situation?
I guess the big piece is the reassurance. I mean, these cases are so rare. Yes, they sometimes do happen, and when they do happen, we are much better at finding children than we ever were before as a country, but I think the big message here is no one has the right to hurt kids. And if that's what we, here's the deal. No one has the right to hurt kids. If anyone is ever doing something that hurts you, your body, makes you feel scared, let's talk about who the five adults are in your life that you could tell. And we say five because sometimes it's the person on that list who's causing the problem. And we say five because sometimes it's the first person we tell doesn't help. But use this time to help kids identify who are the positive adults in their life, who are the healthy adults in their life, that they can reach out to if they need help. Because the good news is there are way more people out there who want to help kids than the very few who do harm them.
Let's go to the phones now with John joining us from Richland Center. Good morning, John.
Good morning. If it's possible, can you make a reconnection to your guest? It's difficult to hear from her.
Yeah, we have a difficulty, but I understand you work in law enforcement.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on the situation?
I think it's important for people around the abused child to listen to him when he's speaking out. I am a former inspector for La Crosse, and I prevented the drowning deaths of 8 young college students in less than 10 years. Because I did my job and I told them to put a guardrail up. Well, getting on to today, my mother died 2 months ago. Her last words to me were, John, they will never put me in prison for what I did to you. Nobody listened to me. They made me feel that I was to blame because I was talking bad about my mother. She tried to drown me in the bathtub.
John, I'm going to have to cut you short here, and it sounds like there is a lot you are working through. Allison, in terms of this situation that John is feeling right now, what would you say?
First of all, I'm sorry. What should not happen to you? What should not have happened to you? I think that's important for kids to have that safety net of more than one adult to tell, because sometimes the family isn't the safest person to watch the child. Sometimes the family is the problem. And so to know that there are other adults in their lives that they can reach out to if they need help is so important.
Allison, at this time when we see a very positive outcome for a family with a missing loved one, what happens to those other families who are still looking, for someone who has disappeared?
It reminds us that missing people do come home. You know, the National Center has over 5,000 cases where kids were gone for more than 6 months and still recovered. And so when you see those faces, when you see them coming through social media, you see them up in public buildings, to stop and look at those faces and know those faces, because it is knowing faces that helps bring kids home.
And there's also perhaps the chance where they reconnect with their center, with their resources, and say, is there something that happened in this case that isn't happening in ours?
Well, and I think we're always looking at these cases from a prevention lens. You know, I will be very interested in the months down the road to learn more about the offender and where were opportunities that we could have seen if there was a problem before it got to the point of him hurting children. In this case, it's not about what could the child have done to protect herself. That's not what it's about. She did everything right. The question is, what could we do to fail her? Where were those steps that could have, with this person who caused the harm, we could have had some intervention. And so I'll be interested to hear that down the road.
And finally, Allison, as communities look to address abduction and abuse in their own regions and their own cities and towns, what could communities do better, especially on the law enforcement side?
I think we are doing a better job. I mean, when Jacob was taken back in 1989, there were 60% recovery rate for finding missing people, and now the National Center says they're around a 97% recovery rate. So we're doing a good job. I think a lot of it, though, is the proactive, positive conversation. Teaching a child a safety rule, following up with some letters, and really talking about online safety in addition to personal safety, because that is a whole new layer that we see with our, especially with our 11 to 17-year-olds.
So online safety, 11 to 17-year-olds, what are the dangers you're seeing there emerging?
There's a wide variety, and the wonderful thing with Jamie's case is social media can be used for good. You know, it can be used to get her face on Facebook for people to know. The flip side of social media can also be used for bad. We talk about to pay attention to anyone who tries to isolate you from your safety net of people. people try to separate you from the people who love you online and in real life. You know, messages like, no one loves you but me, no one cares about you but me. That's a warning sign. And we see that isolation and we see that attention and affection really used on kids online quite a bit. So to remind kids, you know, that healthy people who want to be part of your life want to be one of many. They don't want to try to separate you from the people who love you.
Allison, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Allison Fay is director of the Jacob Wetterling Resource Center in Minneapolis. It aims to end all forms of child maltreatment through education, training, and prevention and advocacy for victims. Up next, it's news. And then a lack of pay for government workers could mean bad news for national security. We look at the relationship between financial insecurity and on-the-job performance and how it's playing out during the partial government shutdown. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What happens when financial stress, like not getting paid, impacts your job performance? There are people who have been declared essential in this partial government shutdown, now stretching into day 25. To name just a few, TSA screeners, FBI agents, air traffic controllers. What happens to national security during this time of instability? Is it compromised? It's questions we're posing to Yers Miras. He is an assistant professor of management and human resources at the University of Wisconsin School of Business. His research looks at how employment shapes people's personal finances and the resulting consequences for individuals and organizations. Yers, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So it's not unusual to be worried about a personal financial situation, but how big of a source of stress is money for employees in America?
Well, money, a recent report by the American Psychological Association shows that about 70% of people in the U.S. worry about money, and it's actually indicated as a source of stress more frequently than work, family, or health issues. So it's pretty widespread, even without the shutdown or what's going on right now.
And so when we say finances, we're not just talking specifically about money per se or about a specific paycheck. It goes bigger than that?
Yeah, so it goes into debt. Do you have savings? I mean, savings is a really big part of it. There was a report, I think, by The Atlantic a while ago that reports that most Americans, or about more than 50%, doesn't have $400 in case of an emergency. And so all of that goes into that. Student loans go into that. And all of that combines together to make people worried about their current financial state as well as their financial future.
So how do you make the leap from financial insecurity, really being concerned about your situation, to an ability to do your job?
So what's interesting about that, a new project that I have going on with Joe Gladstone, who's a professor at UC London, we're looking at what really does happen after a specific financially stressful event. So not just a stressful event, for something that negatively affects your personal finances. And what we find is that when people have these events, it takes away from their ability to do their job, which makes both their quantity of work suffer, so how much they do, but also their quality of work suffer. And this is because of anxiety, that in response to these events, people experience anxiety, and that anxiety takes away from the attention that they can give to their work tasks.
So workers can be stressed about a lot of things, their personal health, a divorce, an aging parent in a nursing home. That's just a few examples, all of which are capable of hindering employee performance on the job. How are these stressors different from overall financial worry?
So they're obviously interrelated, right? So if you have a health problem, it's probably going to affect your finances in some way or form for most people. what was interesting in this project where we looked at these daily stressors is that we, even accounting for health stressors, are also looking at health or stressors that are impacting people's health. This has somewhat of the same effects, but not nearly as strong as finances do, because finances tends to be this these kind of events that affect different aspects of your life, your family, how your relationship with your spouse, and so on and so on. And so that effect that has on your life really creates this anxiety about people and thinking about what's my welfare going to be either today or in the future.
We're talking with Yairs Miras. He's an assistant professor of management and human resources at the University of Wisconsin School of Business, looking at the impact of pay and financial security to on-the-job performance. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a federal worker who's been impacted by the government shutdown? If so, is that causing you financial strain? How are you dealing with it? And what about you, non-federal workers? Have concerns about financial stability impacted your ability to do your job? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Yairs, let's take your research and apply it now to the federal workers, the federal government. Put this into context of the partial government shutdown. And if worker productivity is compromised, does that impact the health of our overall economy?
Yes, obviously, because if financial insecurity at the individual level is affecting people's ability to do their work, it's going to affect their productivity. And in aggregate, it's going to affect the productivity within countries, within regions. So we would expect there to be a link between financial insecurity and productivity.
Some federal employees have been deemed essential, like TSA agents, air traffic controllers. They have high pressure, high responsibility jobs. Can we realistically expect these workers to do the job to the best of their ability when they don't know when the monies may start flowing again, even if they will get that back pay?
No, it's very difficult already to do those kinds of jobs. If you think about TSA and sitting in front of a monitor trying to pay attention to different nuances in the scans that are coming through, under normal circumstances, without any financial stress, without any stress, that's already a very difficult job. Think also air traffic controllers, very difficult job under normal circumstances. Now you're adding $0 paychecks to that. That is not a good combination. And so, yes, are we less safe because of the shutdown? Absolutely.
So when we look at this where, you know, supervisors don't have control over the situation, this really goes to the highest office in the land where President Trump is having these conversations with lawmakers. When a supervisor doesn't have control of the situation because it is being impacted from above, what can supervisors do to help in these situations?
It's really difficult in that point because there's really no good advice you can give to people in those situations because everyone has to make do under the circumstances that they have. I think what's also very difficult is because there is no end in sight right now, right? If there is one paycheck that you miss, you could say, well, you're going to get the next paycheck. You're going to get that back pay. But right now, if President Trump says, well, this might go on for a month, for a year, for longer, well, then it's hard for supervisors to give any kind of hope or way to reduce that uncertainty in their lives. And so I think for supervisors, it is a very difficult position to be in because they have to make sure the work gets done. But at the same time, they also understand, and they're not getting paid themselves.
So as you dig deeper into this research about how our bank account balance and other financial worries in our life can perhaps make us more error prone in our work, what are some surprising things you're finding as you dig into this?
Well, one surprising thing is that just how extensive it is and how many people experience it. Even when we look at, for example, truck drivers, which are relatively, if you look at their income, they're within the middle class. They're making about $50,000, $70,000 a year, which is what we would think of as middle class, good living. They're living in relatively low cost of living areas. Even among those types of populations, we still see very widespread financial worry. And that is because your objective financial situation and how you feel about it can vary. And so you can have people who have, you know, relatively large incomes who still are worried about their financial situation. You can have people who have more modest incomes who are much less worried about their financial situation. And so I think this difference between objective and subjective financial well-being was something that's really surprising.
And so when you go to measure this, how do you measure these types of things? And you could, because your on-the-job performance can be very subjective. I mean, one person may say, you're doing great. Another person be like, I don't think so.
Yeah, I think this is the good part about technology, and a lot of companies and organizations is that there is now more access to objective data. And usually when we do these kinds of studies, we tend to rely on objective outcome data because we know that there's a lot of error that goes into subjective performance evaluations. And so when we try to link finances to performance, we use these objective indicators with truck drivers. We've used accidents, for example. So we tried to use ways in which there are objective effects on performance.
What might be other examples of objective data you would look at besides, you know, truck drivers and the number of accidents?
Well, you can think of, for example, if you're thinking hospitals, mm-hmm. right? So we've done studies with certified nursing assistants. There you can look at patient safety, patient outcomes. If you're thinking about cashiers, now a lot of stores are tracking how long it takes them to serve customers. So you can use that as a way to measure performance. And so I think companies, because of technology, are getting more sophisticated in how they can measure performance, because they're also realizing that those subjective performance evaluations might not always be useful.
Is it useful for companies to gather more of this data on these objective ways to look at their employees and as it pertains to their work performance?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it can provide a lot of insight. At the University of Wisconsin, we're now creating a class actually called People Analytics, where we're teaching students to use this data in a way where they can add value to companies and better manage employees. And so I think it is potentially a positive change.
Talking with Yairz Miraz, he is an assistant professor of management and human resources at the UW School of Business. His research looks at how a person's financial resources essentially can make them more accident or error prone in their work. Your insights are welcome, 800-642-1234. Have concerns about financial instability impacted your ability to do your job? If so, how has that played out to you? Let's talk about it, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. About 380,000 federal workers are required to stay at home right now. Another 420,000 must work without pay. Many of them faced their first missed paychecks Friday, and we're looking at what this means for on-the-job performance and worker productivity. Researchers have found that when someone is worried about their financial situation, that they have less cognitive capacity available to them, and this living on the edge financially will eventually spill over into their work performance. We're looking at the implications as the partial government shutdown is in its 25th day. And Years Mirez is our guide. He is an assistant professor of management and human resources at the UW School of Business. Talking about here is the crux of this research. Your thoughts and questions are welcome at 800-642-1234. How do you focus on doing your job well when your mind might be elsewhere? What role should employers play here? Are you a federal employee on furlough? How are you coping with the financial stress? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So Years, in this partial government shutdown, what recommendations do you have for departments, for agencies, as they work through this time of furlough and this time of essential workers being on the job in high-stress situations?
I think right now it's during the shutdown, departments, agencies, to the best of their abilities, because obviously they're also affected by not having enough staff to really do anything. I think it's providing resources. I think that's really what you can do, of providing as much access and very easy access for these workers to resources that are out there through which they can get help throughout the shutdown. I think that's really all you can do throughout it, because again, everyone's situation is different. Some people might be able to borrow from friends and family. Others may have no one they can go to. And so providing very easy access to resources, I think, can be really useful as long as this shutdown lasts.
I've also been seeing banners on the front of websites for credit cards, you know, going in and checking my credit card. There's a banner there saying, if you're affected by this, please call this number. Is that good to have?
It might be. It depends on what it is. I'd be skeptical sometimes about some of these advertisements, because they might offer some relief, credit card relief, but then there's going to be a bigger interest rate once you actually get your back pay, because these companies are doing this knowing that federal workers are going to get that back pay. And so you could look. I would encourage anyone to look into anything, but obviously be skeptical.
Let's go to Glenda now, joining us from Harvard, Illinois. Glenda, hi.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just was listening in, and I work as a site manager for Harvard Community Senior Center, and because we're under county funding, a lot of times our resources are pretty low, and so I understand what it's like to live on, a dime, basically. And interesting that you made the observation that it doesn't always mean that people that make more money are happier or doing better, because I'm just happy when I can, make rent and pay bills and things like that, and I'm perfectly content with that. But when you're operating at a level that is below that, and I just turned six, so it's difficult to go out and interview and find, other work. I'm at around, I think, $18,000 a year, which is incredible that I can continue to survive without any government help, and I mean, my rent is half that. So it's difficult. And there are days when you feel like your performance is being extremely affected by the worries, like this morning I'm driving my car in to get my car repaired, and that's going to take my account down to peanuts.
Glenda, thank you so much for the details of your situation. Years, when you hear that, obviously she's figured out how to make it work, but still there is stress.
Yeah, and so you have a lot of people. I think one of the things that financial insecurity does is it makes people incredibly adaptive. And because you're so focused on it, people get very creative, very innovative at trying to find ways to manage their situation. And if you hear these stories, and as I've done this research, you hear more of those stories, you're kind of in awe of how people manage their situations, have managed to get through for years on end. But it's still going to affect them. And I think that's really the big takeaway, is that, yes, they're managing, but there are better alternatives.
Glenda, do you feel you've been very creative in how you get by?
Yeah, definitely. There are ways of, a supplemental income, like, doing painting jobs. I used to paint, for 9 years until I started taking care of my mother, and then for 3 years cared for her. And after that, losing the momentum of the painting and getting a little bit older, I started to look for something else and sort of fell into the senior center job. And I love my seniors and I love the work, but the income is so minimal that it's hard. But yet at the same time, you're in a situation with surrounded by a lot of people. The creativity sometimes comes in by, watching for those opportunities and encouraging others and various things like that. So
yeah, and so when you look at Glenda's situation and what companies, organizations, she's at a small senior center, but outside, what can organizations do to try to mitigate this anxiety about money?
So a lot about the anxiety that comes is from a lack of what I call safety nets. And this is anything from health insurance to saving for retirement to having some type of emergency savings. So what happens, or what really drives financial worry, is having this peace of mind. You know that if something happens to you, you have some fallback. And it's when people have that uncertainty about what's going to happen to them, that's really when financial worry kicks in.
So ultimately, this partial government shutdown will end, but it's probably not the last time we'll see a government shutdown. What do you think needs to be done before that to address some of these concerns we've talked about today?
Well, I think one thing in terms of the government shutdown specifically that needs to be considered is when these employees are getting back pay, that they should be treated just as contracting organizations. You receive interest on the back pay we owe you. And this is partly for fairness, I think, but also partly because once they get their back pay, they're going to have other financial issues that come up. It's not like they're going to be able to pay back everything that they had to do to manage their situation right now. And so instead of providing just what they're owed, providing some interest can give that buffer for them to be able to pay down those expenses they had to incur just to make it through. Besides the shutdown specifically, I think there needs to be broader conversations about things like medical coverage and that really tie into, trying to create these safety nets to reduce financial insecurity in the U.S.
And sometimes you look at it, it's a question of haves and have-nots with companies. You look at large companies that can offer, daycare and dry cleaning on site and what have you and all of these services, and smaller companies like a senior center, there's no way.
Yeah, it's inequality isn't just about income. That's really what's always been talked about. But it's also about just being prone to experiencing financial insecurity because you don't have access to all these safety nets. And that can go, again, medical coverage, but also things like you mentioned, childcare, which is a huge expense if you're not provided that through your employer.
And in our last few seconds here, how do you plan on advancing your research in this area?
I think the next steps are really to try to look more closely at these safety nets and trying to make the case that, if we provide people with these safety nets, not only will those people who are experiencing this financial insecurity be better off, companies will be better off, and the society in general will be better off.
Years, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Years Miras is Assistant Professor of Management and Human Resources at the University of Wisconsin School of Business, and his research looks at how employment shapes people's personal finances and the resulting consequences for individuals and organizations. Just ahead, we talk about figuring out how to save money when you really don't have anything to spare. That personal finance discussion is coming up next here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.